Today on Wings, by special permission from Mother Jones Magazine.
This is the Mother Jones Podcast. I'm Jamila King in Brooklyn. On today's show, our exclusive interview with Stacey Abrams, Democratic Party powerhouse from the great state of Georgia. Stacey Abrams knows what voter suppression looks like. She was the first Black woman gubernatorial nominee in U.S. history, a race she lost narrowly for reasons that she'll get into on this podcast. Over the past 2 years, she's thrown herself into voting rights work, founding the organizations Fair Fight and Fair Count. Last Thursday, Stacey Abrams joined Mother Jones voting rights reporter Ari Berman. We'll let Ari take it away from here.
Stacey, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm ensconced in my dining room in Atlanta, Georgia, and doing my best to socially distance and stay sheltering in place until it truly is safe to go back out.
How prepared do you think the U.S. is right now to hold a presidential election in a pandemic?
The United States has the capacity to hold an election in a pandemic. What we lack is the will and the investment. South Korea had their first incidence of COVID-19 around the same time the United States did. On April 15th, in the midst of a pandemic, they held the single highest turnout election since the 1990s, and they did it safely. What they did was use all of the tools in their toolbox, scale them up, and adopt the best practices. Every state in America has the capacity for vote by mail. Every state has used vote by mail. We simply have to scale it and remove the barriers that have impeded usage by others. We have the ability for in-person voting, in-person early voting, and in-person voting on the day of the election. We simply have to make it safer. But any argument that we don't have the capacity is wrong. We were able to vote during the Civil War. We were able to vote during the 1918 Spanish flu. There is no excuse for not holding our elections in 2020. What we lack is the investment that has to come from the federal government because of the nature of this crisis. And we have to have the willingness to say that we want our democracy to work even in a crisis.
How prepared do you think states like Georgia are to vote by mail? Only 6% of Georgians, for example, voted by mail in 2018.
While only 6% may have used it, we saw a dramatic increase. In fact, we saw the largest increase among African Americans because we sent out vote by mail applications. My campaign in 2018 sent out 1.6 million vote by mail applications. We followed it up with both encouragement, but also education. And so the reality is we have to think about this in two pieces. There's the infrastructure for vote by mail, and then there's the faith in vote by mail. The infrastructure exists, but we have to scale it up. And that can be done if we invest now. That's why the resources that Speaker Pelosi has demanded in the next COVID package has to be put in place, because that's the way we make it work. But the faith piece is also important. There's been a lack of trust in vote by mail, particularly from communities of color, because the rejection rate for communities of color is much higher than for the white communities. And in Georgia, we had a specific incident with the current governor, then Secretary of State, who arrested and jailed 12 people for using absentee ballots properly. They lost their jobs, they lost their reputations, and not a single person was convicted. But that created a dampening effect on the use of absentee ballots. We have to use the gold standard of making sure that absentee ballots that vote by mail can be accessible by any voter who wants to use it. And there are pillars for how we can make it work in every single state, but we can do it. The alternative is what we saw happen in Wisconsin. That was a tragedy and a travesty that should not be repeated in a democratized, industrialized nation.
Now, I wanted to ask you about Wisconsin. The election there, Republicans refused to postpone it. They refused to mail ballots to every registered voter, and thousands of people were forced to choose between their health and their ballot. When you saw all the long lines of voters wearing masks, what was your takeaway from all of that?
Number one, that I'm glad we started fighting about this early on. Fair Fight 2020 is one of the organizations I created in the wake of my election. And what we are doing is working across 18 states. We have 43 staffers already in place. And we were in place in Wisconsin, able to work arm in arm with the chair of the party. We were able to man hotlines, to answer questions, to provide information each time there was a new iteration of the election. When Governor Evers tried to make it safer, when the Republicans pushed back, when the Supreme Court interfered and actually condemned voters to having to go in person, but still did one good thing by saying that absentee ballots could be postmarked and still counted. But what we knew about, and the reason I anticipated there would be a challenge, was that we knew there was going to be something catastrophic that would happen in 2022 elections. I had no idea it would be a pandemic, but we knew that it would happen. And as you know well, voter suppression is systemic. It's built into the process. And while in the 1960s, what preceded the 65 Voting Rights Act was that the law said you could not vote, what's happened since that time has been the use of bureaucratic hurdles and administrative oversight to make it more complicated to vote. But that's the same effect of voter suppression. What we have to learn from Wisconsin is that we have the capacity to still make it work if we start early enough. Because part of what happened in Wisconsin was that the decisions were made in a matter of weeks. We now have months to prepare, but we have to remember that for those thousands of people who stood in line, for those who had masks or didn't, and for the poll workers who didn't have adequate equipment, 52 people have already been confirmed with COVID-19. That should not happen. And we know that what we risk is that if we do not anticipate and put in place the right operations, we will face what Wisconsin faced. I think what COVID-19 has done is reveal what has been a systemic challenge for most of the 21st century. Those who have faced voter suppression have faced it alone. They have felt isolated, that it was user error, or they felt unheard. But now that more and more people are seeing how the systems actually work, they're understanding that if you're in a state where you want to vote by mail, but they require an excuse, the state of Alabama refused to acknowledge that a pandemic should be a valid excuse. We have states, 10 states actually, that require that you either have a signature from a witness or a notary, which are not possible right now. We have states that have closed polling places that are isolated, and we have communities, especially like the Native American communities, that simply have no options. And the reality is those things existed in 2019, 2016, 2012, 2008. The difference is because of COVID-19, people are seeing it in real time and they're understanding its impact. And so I do not welcome a pandemic, but I think what has happened is that people see what's going on. What they're also seeing is that there is a stark divide between Democrats and Republicans. Democracy itself is not partisan. When you break the machinery of democracy, you break it for everyone. But what is in sharp relief in this moment is that Democrats are working to make certain that every eligible voter has access to the ballot. And there is a group of Republicans who are working just as hard to ensure that they can narrow the universe of possible voters. Luckily, there has been bipartisan support of vote by mail, of safer voting, of better instruction. That bipartisanship has to win out because we cannot allow a conservative minority of thought to limit access to democracy in one of the most pivotal elections in our lifetimes.
I want to ask you about Georgia. I'm sure most of our listeners know, but for those that don't know, there were 214 polling places closed. There were 53,000 voter registrations put on hold before the election, 80% from voters of color. There were 1.5 million people purged from the voting rolls. There were 4-hour lines in Black neighborhoods. I'm sure there were other examples that I didn't mention. How directly do you think this was in terms of a factor of costing you the election?
We know based on an independent analysis that the number of purged voters included more than 100,000 who should never have been taken off the rolls. We know that the closure of 214 polling places had a direct effect on between 54 and 85,000 people not being permitted to vote. We know that Georgia had one of the highest rejection rates of absentee ballots. We had a high rejection rate of provisional ballots. We had people who actually had to leave lines because in Georgia, you do not get paid for time off for elections, which meant that there was a poll tax on every voter who had to stand in a 4-hour line. And the reality is for a lot of these folks, it was 4 hours when they tried in the morning and 4 hours when they tried again at night. which meant they had no real opportunity to vote. If you do basic math, the gap between myself and Brian Kemp was 50, a little under 55,000 votes. And what that means is that you had more than 200,000 to 300,000 people who could have been able to participate in this election, who were not allowed to, who were constrained because of his behavior. He was the Secretary of State. He oversaw the elections. He was the referee. He was the scorekeeper and the contestant. I will never know for certain what could have happened, but I know absolutely that voter suppression interfered in a free and fair and transparent election, and that should not stand in this country.
When you see Brian Kemp rushing to reopen the state, when you see him say that he didn't know that coronavirus cases could be asymptomatic, do you just think, man, I should have had this job instead?
I think that the voters of Georgia were robbed of their opportunity to make an informed decision. I believe that voter suppression stole the voices of thousands of Georgians. If I were the governor, I would have followed the facts and the science. I would have known early that asymptomatic people can carry the disease. I wouldn't have led Georgia to be one of the last states to shut down, and we certainly wouldn't have been one of the first to reopen. In part because Georgia, like much of the South, has the highest proportion of African Americans in the country. So 58% of Black folks live in the South. We know that Black communities are disproportionately affected by COVID-19. We also know that that people of color writ large, and Blacks in particular, are the most likely to be uninsured, to have high poverty rate, to have underlying medical conditions, and to lack access to public benefits. That combination means that his responsibility is to be extraordinarily vigilant about the needs of his community, and he has not followed that responsibility. Instead, since the reopening of the state, we've seen our COVID rate skyrocket by 40%. We still are one of the slowest in testing. There is a contact tracing program that's getting up and running, but it's woefully behind where it should be. And we have one of the highest testing rates for coronavirus, and that's only because these are the ones we know about. We're at more than 30,000 already, and that number is continuing to climb. And so, yes, this is a perfect example of why I believe voting matters and having the right to choose your leaders matter. People may have decided not to pick me anyway, but because of voter suppression, we will never know what the choice of the people would have been.
How concerned are you that in 2000, there could be a situation like in Georgia where there's a very close disputed election and it could go to the Supreme Court, but this case, it's not a governor's race that's on the line. It's the election of the next president, and the Supreme Court declares Donald Trump the winner. How concerned are you? Am I being too outlandish in raising that with you, or is that a real possibility now?
I believe what we saw happen in Wisconsin legitimates any degree of concern about how the Supreme Court is going to handle questions of elections. And if you look at the pattern of behavior, you look at the Shelby decision that invalidated Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act by eliminating the formulary. If you look at what happened in North Dakota in 2016, when they refused to enjoin the disenfranchisement of thousands of Native Americans who could not possibly meet the standards, but were told, well, there aren't enough of you and there are more of them, so we're not going to change the rules because you're only a minority being hurt, not the majority. What we saw happen with Wisconsin, that has created a through line of deep concern. And let's not forget what happened in 2000. We know that the Supreme Court has not proven themselves to be good actors in this, except if you look at the Wisconsin decision, their willingness to acknowledge that for voters who are trapped at home by COVID-19, that they shouldn't be held accountable for when the U.S. Postal Service delivers the mail. The postmark matters, not the date of arrival. So I think the macro is that we have to recognize that anything could happen, but the opportunity and the obligation is to work against it. And this is why I'm excited.
We're listening to Stacey Abrams in an exclusive interview with Mother Jones's voting rights reporter, Ari Berman.
Thanks to Mother Jones for sharing this interview with Wings. It took place May 7th, 18 days before George Floyd was killed.
A lot of people are asking for your thoughts on the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. It happened in your own state, the 25-year-old Black man that was shot. What does it say that a killing like this would happen in the year 2020, and that this seemingly was swept under the rug until just a few days ago.
This family has been suffering in silence, shut off from the opportunity to not only express their grief, but demand justice. What we saw happen in that video, what I read about in those stories, is a violation of every notion of decency and justice. It was murder. And that murder should be held to account, and the murderers should as well. But we have a system in our country, a system that should also be held accountable. And I don't want to exempt or excuse anyone from their responsibilities. That means the DAs who pushed this along and refused to act, the police or the sheriffs who did or did not decide to charge. At every step, we have to remember that the way we get the justice we deserve is by electing people who believe we deserve that justice. And that's why I'm so vigilant about pushing the issue of voting and of the census, because the districts that are drawn, the lines that determine our value and our power, it's determined by the census and it's lived through the vote. We need judges, we need DAs, we need sheriffs who actually hold themselves accountable and hold those who commit crimes accountable. And that did not happen, but hopefully will happen. And I intend to be part of the chorus pushing to make sure that Ahmaud Arbery gets the justice he deserves.
Another thing you're doing a lot of work on that has been derailed by coronavirus is the 2020 census. What do we need to do to get the census back on track? And how concerned are you about what's happening to it?
I'm deeply concerned about the census. The Census Bureau has done as much as it can. They're asking for delays that would push back the non-response closure period to the end of October instead of mid-August, as it would have been. But we've got some major challenges. We know that rural communities, 6.2 million people, have not received the hand-delivered census packets that they need because they cannot complete it online. That includes most of our Native American families. Those communities do not have access, and they have to have those hand-delivered packets, as well as rural communities that are now facing the onslaught of COVID in ways that were not predicted about a month ago. We know that because of the Trump administration's deep antipathy towards a fair census, that they have shut down all 39,000 question centers that were available to people in 2010 to understand how to finish the census. We know that they've delayed the counting of non-traditional folks, meaning those who are homeless, those who are living on college campuses, who are living in nursing homes. Those counts have been delayed until June, which particularly for college students is dangerous, because if their families filled out the census presuming they would be counted by the college, but the college isn't counting them because they don't know if they're going to re-enroll, there might be thousands of college students who go uncounted. We're not seeing the work to count the homeless, which is critical if we ever want the financial resources to fully tackle the homeless issue. And the last major concern I have is that because we don't have folks in the field knocking doors, getting the response rates up, especially in hard to count communities, the Census Bureau is going to use a statistical process called imputation. What that means is that they're going to look at neighborhoods where people didn't respond, and based on the demographic data of that neighborhood, they're going to impute who else lives there. Well, if you're a minority, they're never going to guess it's you, which means minority communities that are already undercounted risk being statistically erased from the narrative of America because we don't have the ability to go out and knock.
Another big issue right now is what's happening to the Postal Service. I'm sure you saw the Washington Post article yesterday that Trump is going to name the chief fundraiser for the Republican convention to be Postmaster General. A lot of people are asking how this could affect the post office, how Trump's attacks could affect vote by mail in November, how it could affect the census. So what's your concern about what's happening to the post office?
This is a rancorous, terrible decision that is grounded in his deepest incompetence, but also his meanness. We should be frightened, but we should also be fighting. People need to reach out to their congressmen and their congresswomen, demanding action, to their senators, especially Republicans who represent rural areas, who understand that if you quadruple the prices, that there are people who will be priced out of the market who cannot afford to survive in an America where the post office doesn't exist. The post office is a vital utility in our nation. For many communities, especially rural communities, it is their pharmacy. It's the only way they get their medication. In the moment of COVID-19, it's the way people get their food. for communities that have no other, there is no FedEx down the street, there is no responsibility by UPS to show up. The Postal Service is the only way they have communication with the broader world. And this attempt to not only privatize, but politicize the post office is very dangerous. And it's directly connected to vote by mail. We know that vote by mail is absolutely essential to certain communities. And we know that if it is expanded, it will likely increase participation in our election.
I want to ask you about a few things that are in the news right now. The first is the vice presidency. You have been criticized for, quote unquote, campaigning to be vice president. So I want to just ask you about your approach to why you want the job, what you'd think you'd bring to it, and why it's important that a Black woman be put on the ticket.
Let's begin with the fact that I have gotten a question about the vice presidency for 14 months, and my response has never wavered. The reality is I answer the questions I'm asked with candor and with honesty. I will always be unequivocal when I'm asked the question, because I believe that it is important for me to speak not only for myself, but to speak to the young woman who doubts her capacity, to speak to the people of color, to those who've been told that they are not enough. I am not going to deny my agency or pretend that I do not want something or that I'm not capable of something simply because of traditions that never imagined me. That said, I believe that Joe Biden is going to make his choice. He has been a vice president. He knows what he needs. He knows what the future is going to call for based on his experience for 40 years. I think he has the courage of his convictions to know the kind of leadership he can bring and the person he needs by his side to do so. And I will be out there campaigning hard for him, whether it's by his side or as a surrogate. But more than anything, I want every person who has ever been underestimated or disadvantaged or marginalized to believe that they too can be the face of leadership. And that means when I'm asked the question, I give a straightforward answer.
Another thing that a lot of people are asking about are the accusations that Tara Reid made against the vice president. Did you find Vice President Biden's Morning Joe appearance to be persuasive and satisfactory when he addressed the Tara Reid allegations?
I am pleased that Vice President Biden directly addressed these issues himself. I support his answer, but more importantly, I support his call for a process. And it's a call that's actually gone beyond the vice president. We need a process for survivor justice in this country. Women should not have to adjudicate their issues in the press or in politics. And because we have refused time and again to create this process to make certain that women can be seen and heard, we continue to relitigate, unfortunately, the worst parts of our system, getting trapped in the cycle instead of making a pathway for women to be seen and heard, and for men. This is largely an issue that women face. We can't forget, though, that for the transgender community, for men, there is also sexual violence and sexual harassment. And so our responsibility should and must be creating a process for survivor justice.
So the vice president has said that he's going to pick a running mate who is going to be a woman. Do the Tara Reid allegations put whoever that woman is in a challenging position to have to respond to this over and over?
As I said, I believe that Vice President Joe Biden credibly and effectively denied these allegations. And I believe him. We have to, though, make certain that no matter who is running with Vice President Biden, that our attention is focused on making sure that no one has to face this alone and that survivor justice becomes an essential part of the conversation.
One more thing that people are asking about, do you have any reaction to the Justice Department dropping charges against Michael Flynn? And do you think it's indicative of a broader problem with the rule of law in this country?
I think it's indicative of a problem with the person in charge of our country, who has not only demonstrated incompetence, but has demonstrated autocratic behaviors that should terrify all of us. When he installed yes men in the highest levels of government who have taken away the legitimacy of our system and replaced it with favoritism and with a level of disinterest in justice, we should be terrified. Donald Trump has told us who he was from the very beginning. His willingness to replace generals, to replace leaders with sycophants has signaled to us that he does not care about our country. His willingness to shut down the CDC and prevent them from providing good information to the country on how to protect ourselves in the midst of COVID-19 as reopenings happen. I am not surprised by what he's done with Flynn. I'm not surprised by what he did with the CDC, because he is a man wholly incapable of both accountability or courage. And that incompetence layered on top means that he is breaking the very institutions we rely on. But that's the populist playbook. Authoritarians get into power and they start to dismantle the very institutions that should protect the citizens from their misbehavior. He has been doing it with the suborning of the US Senate. And until we take the Senate and take the White House, his type of behavior will continue.
The news is so bleak right now, and we've touched on some pretty heavy topics in this interview. What are you hopeful about? What keeps you going and optimistic at this time?
Because I know what we're capable of as a country. My first election was 1992. I was the only 18-year-old. I turned 18 December of 91. The only 18-year-old whose most excited moment was going to register to vote. I'm the daughter of two civil rights activists who were activists as teenagers. My dad was arrested when he was 14, registering Black people to vote in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. We teased them that my mom was doing the same work. She was just smart enough not to get caught. But they raised us to believe that we have a responsibility, but more importantly, that we have opportunity and possibility. My great-grandmother, her grandparents were slaves. Her parents were sharecroppers. In 2018, I became the first Black woman nominated to be governor of a major party in American history. I don't have the luxury of bleakness because I'm a shining example of what is possible. But my responsibility is not to rest on either the successes or the challenges that I face, but to do the work necessary to make the next generation even more hopeful about what's to come.
That was Stacey Abrams interviewed by Ari Berman for a live conversation May 7th. To see the full conversation on our website, on Facebook, YouTube, or Twitter. If you want more Stacey Abrams, you can read her book, Our Time Is Now, available everywhere books are sold on June 9th.
Hi, I'm Camille Squires, and I'm an editorial fellow in Mother Jones's San Francisco office. Here are the credits for today's show. Theme music for the Mother Jones podcast was composed by Micah Barrick at Hear Film. This week's episode was edited by Molly Schwartz. It was mastered and executive produced by James West. The architect behind the event's live stream was Mark Helenowski, with additional production by Jamila King. And, credit where credit's due, Mother Jones is supported by you, our listeners and readers. So thank you.
Thank you, Mother Jones Magazine, for sharing this interview with Wings. That website is motherjones.com. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit wingsradio.org/wordpress for recent shows, and facebook.com/wingsradio for a daily news feed. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works on the maternal gift economy can be found at gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.